Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, February 14, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will hear a litigation update on the case pending cert in the Supreme Court, Farha v. United States. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Paul Kaminar, Senior Fellow at the Administrative Conference of the United States, and Jeff Lampkin, Partner at Molo Lampkin, and John G. Malcolm, Director, and Ed Gilbertson and Sherry Lindberg Gilbertson, Senior Legal Fellow at the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, will join us as moderator. I will turn it over to John Malcolm to get us started. After opening remarks, we will go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, John. The floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much. Well, so the Farha case, this is a healthcare fraud case that raises some very interesting questions. So one of the questions that the case raises is whether it is appropriate for the government to bring a criminal prosecution against someone for violating a statute that is arguably ambiguous. A second question raised by this case is whether the district court, through its jury instructions, watered down the mens rea standard that the law requires and whether that should make a difference. We have two very distinguished speakers here with us today who have been involved in some form or fashion with the case. The first person whom we will hear from is Jeff Lampkin. So Jeff is a founding partner at Molo Lampkin here in Washington, D.C. He's a graduate of Haverford College and Stanford Law School. He then clerked for Judge Alex Kaczynski on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court. Before founding his own firm, Jeff was a partner at Kellogg Huber and at Baker Botts. He also served in the Department of Justice as an assistant solicitor general and has argued 22 cases before the United States Supreme Court. For purposes of today's discussion, it's important to note that he was part of the trial and appellate teams for one of Mr. Farha's co-defendants, Paul Behrens, in the case that we will discuss today. Jeff, let me turn it over to you.
Well, thanks very much. So I'm going to start and give a little bit of a background on the prosecution. Todd Farha and his co-defendants were all executives at WellCare HMOs. A relator or would-be relator taped approximately 1,800 hours of conversations in the hopes of filing a QTAM action, which ultimately ended up producing a 200-agent raid at dawn at the WellCare premises. When the government commits that type of resources to a raid rather than submitting a document request, it's pretty predictable that somebody's going to be indicted, and sure enough, folks were. But in the end, the case really came down to a dispute about a reporting methodology under a now-repealed Florida statute. The WellCare HMOs had contracts to provide what are called behavioral health services, essentially mental health services, to Florida Medicaid patients. They would receive premiums, and the statute and their contracts required them to spend 80% of the premiums for the provision of behavioral health services. And if they didn't spend that 80% for the provision of behavioral health services, they had to give back the difference. Now, one of the things that's unusual about this case is the agency responsible for this didn't issue any regulations on how to calculate your pay and what you spent for the provision of behavioral health services. The Affordable Care Act, by contrast, has a ream of regulations about how you go about calculating things. There's no guidance on related party transactions. How do you account for those? Nothing. And there's no dispute that the WellCare HMOs provided outstanding services, much better than what was going on before they started contracting with the Florida Healthcare Agency. So to provide these services, WellCare contracted with affiliates at market rates, and they counted the amount they paid those affiliates as the amounts spent for the provision of behavioral health services. And the government brought this prosecution saying that no. The amounts that the WellCare spent for the provision of behavioral health services is not the amount they paid their affiliates. It's the amount the affiliates paid to doctors and nurses and the like. And that argument really never made sense to me because what's supposed to be reported is the amount the HMOs spent, not how much a subcontractor spent, but that was the government's theory of prosecution. And in the end, it was a theory of prosecution that resulted in convictions. When the evidence came in, it was quite astonishing what came in about what was going on in the field. So other plans were actually counting payments to affiliates under the 80-20 reporting provision, exactly like WellCare. Florida regulators knew about that, and there was no objection. Defendants knew that the Florida regulators knew that this was going on, and they had not objected. And every government witness who testified, and these were lawyers the government called as witnesses because they were the ones who advised WellCare, testified that the methodology that WellCare was using was reasonable, objectively reasonable construction of the statutory and contractual requirements. And then when you got to oral argument at the Court of Appeals, one of the judges said basically, like, there were lawyers all over this. 3-month trial ensues. Jury deadlocks. The judge has to issue an Allen charge. The jury comes back and goes back and deliberates more. And they come back, with a very odd verdict for Todd Farha in particular. For the false statement charges, the materials you submitted to the healthcare agency were false, acquitted. Various years, acquitted. Over and over, acquitted. But then they get to the very last charge for the very same statements that they acquitted them, but they were not. They said they weren't false, criminally false. They convict him for fraud, that they are fraudulent but not false, a result that never made any sense to me until you figure out what went wrong with the jury instructions. So the government at sentencing asks for 20 years. The court departs downward and gives a sentence of 3 years, and we end up on appeal. An appeal has two critical issues, two-hour oral argument before the 11th Circuit. The first issue is an issue we all call the Whiteside issue, but there's a Supreme Court decision called Safeco in the civil context with a very similar concept. And the idea underlying underlying Whiteside and Safeco is, if your conduct is consistent or lawful under a reasonable construction of a legal requirement, you cannot be criminally liable. If it's true under if your conduct is true under an objectively reasonable construction, it's not criminally, there's no actus reus of an actual false statement. And that really makes sense, at least as a policy matter, because if your behavior is consistent with a reasonable construction of the statute, it's lawful under reasonable construction of the statute, that's something that maybe the government should come after you on civilly. You had a reasonable construction, but it's a wrong construction. You owe us more money. But putting someone in jail for following what is objectively reasonable construction of the statute or even your contractual requirements doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And if you had listened to the oral argument tape in the 11th Circuit, it sounds like it's a big contract case. Where do I find that definition? What is that? What is the meaning of that? How does that practically work? It doesn't sound like a criminal case at all. But in the end, the Court of Appeals held that we hadn't shown that the construction was objectively reasonable. It read the statute and regulations not to say that it's the amount you paid for the provision of services, but how much you spent on actual treatment by the doctors. That, in turn, made subjective intent absolutely critical. The only protection against the government reaching here then becomes subjective intent. And that's actually the core key point that comes up in the cert petition. Everyone agreed that healthcare fraud requires the defendant to know that the statements are false, that the claims are false. But the district court held, and the Court of Appeals agreed, that it was sufficient knowledge could be proved by deliberate indifference to the truthfulness of the statement. And there's a big problem with that holding, and that is that the Supreme Court's held exactly the opposite, at least in the civil context. In a case called Global Tech, which was admittedly a patent case, the court held that deliberate indifference is not knowledge for purposes of patent infringement. In that case, it was an odd area where you had to show that you knew you were infringing a patent or you knew that someone else's conduct would infringe a patent. And the Supreme Court said deliberate indifference to the possibility of infringement just doesn't meet the standard. It's too close to negligence, too close to recklessness, not sufficiently protective. The 11th Circuit distinguished that case as a civil case and a civil patent case, which is a distinction that really struck me as unusual. You know, if we're in the patent land and we're worried about transferring money from one person to another or accidentally doing so because someone didn't have enough of a mental state, we end up with a very protective standard, actual knowledge or, at worst, willful blindness. But we go soft on those elements when it's really your liberty at stake. And that just isn't a result that makes any sense to me, which is why I really think that in the end, this is one of those petitions that has some legs. I mean, what does the Supreme Court take? About 4% of the petitions granted, the paid petitions granted, 1% of petitions overall. But this is a result that really is something that the Supreme Court may want to address.
Okay.
So anyway, with that, I thought I might turn it over to Paul for a moment, Tudor.
Okay. Well, so our next speaker is going to be Paul Kaminar. Paul is a public policy and appellate attorney who counsels clients on legal, regulatory, and public policy matters. He graduated from Rutgers College and Georgetown Law School. He's a senior fellow at the Administrative Conference of the United States, and he guest lectures at the U.S. Naval Academy on national security law. He's spoken at several conferences across the country on overcriminalization and regulatory enforcement, and has also testified before Congress on these issues. He's a former senior executive counsel of the Washington Legal Foundation and has taught at the Antonin Scalia Law School, at George Mason University, and at Georgetown Law School. With that, Paul, the floor is yours.
Thanks, John. And I also want to thank the Federal Society for hosting this teleform. I may note that this is the fourth teleform call about this case since July 2015, when it was before the 11th Circuit. I'd like to talk about the two amici briefs that were filed yesterday afternoon, one by the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and 17 criminal law professors, and the second one by Cato and the Reason Foundation supporting the cert petition, and I'd like to discuss both. By the way, both of these briefs will soon be posted on the NACDL website, which has a page devoted to this case listing other articles and pieces by other policy groups. Now, the NACDL brief was drafted by white-collar expert John Klein in San Francisco. And like I said, there were 17 criminal law professors, including a former federal judge, Paul Cassell, from the University of Utah Law School, Professor Stephen Smith from Notre Dame, whose excellent heritage legal background was cited in the brief titled, quote, "A Judicial Cure for the Disease of Overcriminalization," end quote. A couple other professors of note, Julie O'Sullivan from Georgetown, Ira Robbins from AU, and Jeff Parker from Antonin Scalia School of Law, George Mason, and John Hasness at Georgetown and Business School. Now, that brief focused on the mens rea Supreme Court jurisprudence and what the court in those cases said must be what is called, quote, "blameworthy in mind," end quote. That's the Morrissette case and the Alonis case. Now, the brief noted that where statute does not express any required mental state, it doesn't mean that Congress dispensed with it. The burden still requires the prosecutor to show knowledge of the facts that are the elements of the offense. Now, here, the brief in this case, the NACDL brief, argued that the 11th Circuit was not only out of step with those cases, but directly conflicted, as Jeff just said, with the 2011 Global Tech case, where they rejected deliberate indifference in a civil patent infringement case, and you would think all the more so that would be insufficient in a criminal case where your liberty is at stake. Court there also, or the brief argued rather, that by keeping deliberate indifference, you're watering down the standard that leads to prosecutorial abuse and indeed a violation of separation of powers. And there the brief quotes Professor Ira Robbins, who says, quote, "It is the legislature, not the court, which is to define a crime and ordain its punishment," end quote. And the brief sort of concludes with citing a dozen or so criminal statutes that also have the knowledge requirement in there, and then, of course, suggests that if this deliberate indifference standard were to be upheld, those kinds of prosecutions, whether it's 18 U.S.C. 1001, you know, false statement to a government agency, et cetera, can also be prosecuted under that watered-down standard. Now, more of a danger to diluting the mens rea for those criminal statutes that are purely criminal in that NACDL brief is that prosecutors can now go after, if this is upheld, with regulated businesses under a myriad of federal laws, where there's our administrative, civil, or criminal remedies available. And prosecutors can abuse that power, whereas here, as Jeff pointed out, there was no clarifying regulation interpreting what the statute was all about. Now, indeed, that abuse is most prominent here, where the government chose to go after WellCare, and yet with another medical provider that uses similar type of accounting methodology, they went after them only in a civil proceeding and settled for nothing and walked away. Now, the Cato brief then gets into this a little deeper in a more compelling way. That Cato Reason Foundation brief was drafted by Kevin Marshall and Brian Hazen of Jones Day. And that brief makes two major legal and policy arguments. First, it notes that the federal criminal code is loaded with over 4,000 criminal provisions and some 300,000 regulations that can be enforced either administratively, civilly, or criminally. In fact, the brief cites Paul Larkin of the Heritage Foundation, his 2013 Law Review article describing the pathology of these so-called regulatory crimes. Now, these regulatory offenses are not malum in se offenses or offenses that are inherently bad or evil. They are malum prohibitum offenses that can be enforced one of three ways, administratively, civilly, or criminally. For example, the government can take a violator of an EPA regulation before an administrative law judge, have a hearing, maybe impose a fine, maybe go to civil court to get an injunction, et cetera. So they have these alternative remedies. You just can't simply bring a bank robber or a rapist before an administrative law judge, because society only has the criminal law to deal with these malum in se crimes. Now, the second point made in the Cato brief is that it's particularly crucial in the context of regulated industries to keep the mens rea line between criminal and civil misconduct high and clear. This is particularly true because regulated industries involve very complicated and complex rules and regulation. And precisely because these companies are involved in complex rules and regulations issued by the government, such as government contractors, the government does and can conduct inspections, and if they detect problems that are in dispute, they can clear them up by issuing clarifying regulations, et cetera. And as Jeff pointed out here, there were no such clarifying regulations. And I was also at the oral argument, and I sat there for 2 hours, and I thought I was listening to a contractor dispute. They were talking about, well, where in the contract on page 6, where's the clause that defines provider, et cetera. You would not know that this was a criminal case where people's liberty and freedom were at stake. And, you know, the use of the heavy hand of criminal prosecution to regulate these kinds of regulatory offenses can have disastrous effects on businesses. I mean, obviously, the case in point, the big one is the Arthur Andersen case, where the government went after them and the Supreme Court reversed that conviction, but the company went out of business and thousands of employees lost their job. Another more recent one is the Yates case, the fisherman case, where the prosecutors went after this fisherman for throwing undersized fish back in the water and accused him of destroying evidence in violation of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. And that case was reversed on at the Supreme Court, with even Justice Kagan noting that this is symptomatic of an over-criminalization phenomena. And the companies are also threatened by the abusive selective prosecution to go after them criminally, where they're quick to enter in what's called a deferred prosecution agreement or non-prosecution agreement, and that's exactly what happened here. The company said, okay, We give, we'll sign this agreement, and they, through their executives, the CEO, the CFO, the general counsel was indicted under the bus. You know, it's also interesting that even in a civil context, defendants seem to have more due process in terms of conducting discovery, moving forward to dismiss a complaint, summary judgment, et cetera. And in criminal cases, you don't even get that kind of level of due process. So it's really interesting. And I'd like to bring this home by just quoting or citing a case that's in the Eighth Circuit that was cited in the Cato brief, and it's the False Claims Act. And that one, of course, False Claims Act provides for either civil or criminal remedies. In that case, the government went after a doctor's group for civil fraud, saying they were overbilling Medicare for the use of their procedures. The government, the doctor's group argued that, hey, your regulation did not make that clear. They say we can't do what we were doing. The government filed a brief saying, hey, it's the responsibility of the regulated entity, if they're not sure, to contact the government and have them explain what we exactly mean, to which the district court soundly rejected that notion, said it's not on the duty of the regulated entity to come to the government to say, what do you mean by this regulation? It's the duty of the government to make the regulation clear. And the court even said that it was completely fine for a regulated entity in that case to take what the court called a, quote, opportunistic, end quote, view of the regulation to make more profit, because that's what companies are in business for, to make more profit for themselves and their shareholders. So I'd just like to show that case is another example where that kind of mens rea was rejected by the court in the Civil False Claims Act, and all the more so this deliberate indifference should not be sufficient in a criminal case that's now pending before the Supreme Court. So that basically summarizes, you know, those two briefs on the issue.
And this is Jeff. I mean, there is an irony to this case. And that is that if this had been litigated as a breach of contract case, a civil case, I think I'm pretty darn sure I would have won. I really just don't think that they could have gotten across the line on the language of the contract. And there's a true irony that when it is prosecuted as a criminal case, somehow you send people to jail where a civil litigant pressing the exact same position would never have gotten across the line and would probably have lost at summary judgment. And that really, you know, suggests a lot of overreaching by the government, and it also suggests that at the very least we're going to have extremely robust protections when requiring mens rea, because otherwise the "you should have asked us" argument is you go to jail if you fail to ask the government, precisely how would you like me to comply with my contractual requirements.
So in a moment we'll open the floor to questions. Lori, I assume you'll do that. Let me begin by asking one question to either or both of you, which is the issue of the court's instruction here on deliberate indifference, so sort of a recklessness standard. And I guess I have a two-part question. Is one, did the court discuss the fact or find significant at all, and this is the 11th Circuit we're talking about, the fact that on the charges for which they required, you know, knowing falsity, there was an acquittal? And for the charges where there was a deliberate indifference instruction given, even though the law doesn't provide for deliberate indifference, there was a conviction. Did they note that and discuss, you know, why it was okay for that to happen? And I guess my second question is, as I recall, in the charges where there was a conviction obtained, the deliberate indifference was coupled with that the jury had to somehow find an intent to defraud. And I'm wondering, you know, if that is the case, what difference would it make? Is this a case of sort of no harm, no foul? So if you guys could answer that, and then I assume in the meantime people can line up in the queue to ask whatever questions they'd like.
Sure. This is Jeff. I'll try and tackle those. The first one is the court that passed unnoticed. There were charges saying the submissions in 2006 were false, and they charged them as false statements. And there were charges saying those submissions were fraudulent, and they charged them as fraud. The false statement counts led to acquittals. The fraud charges led to convictions. And there's no way to reconcile those two except through one thing, and that is that the false statement charges did not have the deliberate indifference standard. They required knowing falsity, whereas the fraud charges watered down the knowledge of falsity and allowed you to convict and allowed the jury to convict based on deliberate indifference. You should have known or you should have asked type of thing. And so I think that really, you know, sets forth precisely why these sorts of elements are absolutely critical to the protection of individual liberty. With respect to the second question, the court did sort of swirl together the intent to defraud requirement together with the knowledge of falsity requirement to say that, you know, perhaps that was good enough. I don't think that works, and it doesn't work for this reason. Those are separate elements. You have to have an intent to defraud, i.e. you intend to cause people to lose property as a result of your misstatement, and you have to know that your statement is false. The government doesn't get a pass on one element just because it thinks that it proves another. And, you know, the problem is the jury here was asked to convict on a you should have asked type of theory. You should have asked the government how to do this. And when you say, well, intent to defraud and deliberate indifference to falsity are together enough, that's you didn't ask and you thought you could get away with not asking. The jury will convict on that basis. And so I think that the government's theory on that respect or the court's theory on that respect doesn't hold water. These are separate elements. They both need to be proved. And the very fact that they got convicted of fraud for a statement for which they were acquitted in terms of falsity, so there's a legally false statement, but they were fraudulent nonetheless, speaks loudly to what actually happened here.
Paul, anything to add to that?
No, I agree. I think, though, there's one point, correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, that even with the 2005 false statement and fraud charge, he was acquitted of even that fraud charge. He was only convicted of the 2006 fraud charge.
That's right. And it was, you know, for those of you who try criminal cases, you can imagine the moment in that courtroom where the jury was returning its verdict, 2005 false statement, not guilty. 2005 second false statement, not guilty. 2005 first fraud charge, not guilty. 2005 second fraud charge, not guilty. 2006 first false statement charge, not guilty. 2006 second false statement charge, not guilty. Then you get to 2006 fraud. You've already acquitted them. The statement's not legally false. Guilty. 2006 second fraud charge. You've already acquitted them. The statement's not legally false. Guilty. And just the absolute air coming out of the room and everybody, the oxygen just left the room because you can't make sense of that but for the problem with the jury charge.
And this is Paul again. And again, what was amazing that even with this highly complicated, which would be a contract dispute, you had the prosecutors demanding that Mr. Farha go to prison for 20 years. And even the judge was really taken aback and had to use the sentencing guidelines to get it down as low as what he thought he could under the guidelines to 3 years. But one day in prison is excessive for this kind of a violation. And Todd Farha is currently serving his three-year prison term. He's been there since early December. And it's just an injustice that should not continue, and that's why we hope that the court will grant cert and reverse this case.
Okay, let's get to any questions that we may have. We got any in the queue?
All right, let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. All right, I already see our first question, so when you hear the prompt, caller, you may ask your question. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. First of all, it's great to talk with you guys and get your insight. My name is Matt Smith. I'm a state prosecutor, so this is a little outside my area of expertise, but I was particularly drawn to today's forum particular with the reference to deliberate indifference. And I wanted you just, if you could, either of you, just to talk a little bit about how you think deliberate indifference fits in with willful blindness, for example, in like, you know, large narcotics cases where obviously that's been, you know, tried and not been utilized as a defense. How do you see, is the real differing factor here the fact that you're talking about perhaps regulatory practices that have been criminalized, or do you think that there's actually is some type of a difference between deliberate indifference and willful blindness?
Yeah, I think there's a world of difference between deliberate indifference and willful blindness. Now, mind you, in Global Tech itself, the court split whether willful blindness is sufficient for knowledge. Justice Kennedy citing criminal cases saying it just doesn't work in criminal cases. We should demand actual knowledge, and that's all that's good enough. But willful blindness requires two things. It requires, you know, a state of facts that you know make it extremely likely that your conduct is unlawful. And second, it generally requires active conduct to avoid learning that it is unlawful. It's not just that you don't happen to investigate further. It's that you turn your head so as to not know that what you're doing is unlawful. Deliberate indifference is really more akin to recklessness, and it can include things like a failure to inquire. It's a much lesser state. The jury instructions for willful blindness post-Global Tech, a lot of the courts have gone back and revised their pattern instructions to require those two elements. And so, truthfully, in my mind, willful blindness, you're so substantially certain that you're violating the law, you have to actually take active steps to avoid learning. That really is knowledge. Deliberate indifference, there could be the possibility there's a risk that you're wrong and you fail to chase it down. That's a much lesser standard.
Yeah, this is Paul. I think that's an excellent question. The Cato brief gets into that a bit in terms of the difference between deliberate indifference and willful blindness. And Jeff laid that out pretty good. And with drug cases, et cetera, I mean, there's a certain fact that is you're willfully blind on things like, okay, a drug courier comes to you in the airport, gives you a bag and slips you some money, and then you get on board the plane and you say, well, gee, I didn't know I was carrying drugs, et cetera. I mean, you're willfully blind to what is obviously a fact that there's drugs in there. When you're talking about complicated regulations, there's no fact that you're dealing with in terms of what did the agency mean by this statute, what was the agency mean by the contract. So you really can't be willfully blind to those kinds of things. And I also appreciate that you are a state prosecutor, because in this case, Florida was the one that was providing the Medicaid funds. They had jurisdiction to bring this case against WellCare and the executives, and they chose not to. To be sure, the federal government has Medicaid funds there as well and did so. But one of the things in the U.S. Attorney's Manual that was grossly ignored in this case, and that is an instruction to all U.S. attorneys, is that before you do a criminal prosecution, you must investigate whether there are alternative civil or administrative remedies that will solve this problem, and whether there are state remedies by state prosecutors who can handle this at the local level. All that was ignored in this case.
Thank you for your insight, gentlemen. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. While we wait for our next caller, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, February 15th at 3 p.m. The topic of that call will be a retrospective on the Federal Trade Commission. The call will feature Alden Appet, Deputy Director of the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, and the John, Barbara, and Victoria Rumpel Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and the Honorable Maureen K. O'Halson, current Acting Commissioner at the FTC. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls. And you can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Make another call for questions. remember, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. John, do you have any other questions?
Let me ask a question. So this was a 3-month trial with some very sort of unique facts. I'm wondering, you know, why the court, I mean, why is this a good vehicle to explore the mens rea elements of things? How often are charges like this actually brought?
Well, the short answer is this is a great vehicle. For one thing, we're dealing with a pattern instruction. The pattern instruction said reckless indifference is good enough, and the district court actually said deliberate indifference is a little higher. I'll give you that much, but I'm not going to give you what the Supreme Court said, which is actual knowledge. So given the widespread, at least in the 11th Circuit, pattern instruction that's just wrong under global tech, this is going to be happening over and over and over again. And in this context, it makes it particularly clear that knowledge requirement is the critical thing, that the critical element of the case, precisely because of the pattern of the verdict we got. The pattern of the verdict was where they didn't have deliberate indifference being sufficient. The statements weren't criminally false. We acquit. But where you do have the deliberate indifference instruction for fraud, they suddenly become fraudulent, even though fraud has an additional element. Logically, you can't reconcile those two except through the fact that the deliberate indifference instruction watered down mens rea. So I think it's, almost as good a vehicle as you're going to get.
Yeah, this is Paul. I agree with Jeff on that. And like I said earlier, the NACDL brief also gives a laundry list of a number of criminal statutes that require, quote, knowledge, which if this case were appellate can use the deliberate indifference to get these kinds of criminal convictions for those purely criminal statutes. And then the worst issue or scenario is, as in the Cato brief, there are thousands of other statutes where the enforcement can be done administratively, civilly, or criminally. And therefore, the government will be able to use criminal prosecution in those myriad of cases by using this watered-down deliberate indifference, which may not even be good enough for a civil enforcement, as we just saw in the Eighth Circuit Donegan-type case. So this case really is a good vehicle for the court to clarify that this kind of pattern jury instruction that was used in the 11th Circuit and some other circuits should not be upheld. The part of the brief, though, does make that was filed by Seth Waxman at Wilmer Hill, said not only does this case violate clearly global tech, but also other circuits that deal with the mens rea. So there's sort of a split of the circuits. I don't know, Jeff, you want to comment?
Some circuits take global tech more seriously, and even the United States government has now conceded that global tech should apply in criminal cases, at least at the stay stage of these proceedings. So it's very, very odd that the 11th Circuit decided that for some reason global tech doesn't apply in criminal cases, and we're going to have a more lenient mental state when they're putting someone in jail as opposed to just holding them liable for patent infringement. I guess this is Jeff again. One final point that's interesting about this case, and that is that it's not what here isn't what you're deliberately indifferent to or what you would supposedly have knowledge of, and falsity isn't strictly factual. It's legal in part. And that is a critical piece because now you have a lay jury trying to decide what someone thought about the legality of their or whether their conduct was consistent with a statutory term. And that is a very hard thing to ask a jury to do. And if you're going to ask juries to do that, you certainly should have a mens rea instruction that is sufficiently robust to ensure that innocent people do not end up in prison.
Yeah, this is Paul again. Yeah, that's a good point that Jeff makes. In fact, that was also a related argument made in the actus reus part of the case, the Whiteside issue, in terms of whether this was an objectively reasonable interpretation of the statute. That is a question of law that the judge should have decided, but he erroneously gave that to the jury to decide, so kind of fuzzed up the whole thing about the reasonable regulation versus the mens rea, and that's why we got this kind of a split verdict that doesn't make any sense and cries out for the court to take it and clear this up.
Just a reminder, to ask questions, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Oh, we have a caller, so I'll go right to them.
Good afternoon, gentlemen and lady. It's a very good presentation, and I'm wondering if we could kind of back off and look at this in the big picture thing. Where might lie the solutions to this over-criminalization? Some might be judicial, clearly, and you've talked some about that, but are there other things that could be done in the executive branch or reasonable in terms of feasible politically things that could be done in the legislative branch?
Right. Yeah, this is Paul speaking. The caller makes a very good point that this whole issue of over-criminalization can be addressed both in the executive branch by prosecutors using alternative remedies to criminal prosecution to enforce this regulatory monster that we have out there. And the judiciary, of course, has a supreme role of making sure there's a bright line here on the mens rea definition, so we, as a society, make this sharp contrast between an evil mind, criminal intent, and the Eighth Circuit said was basically a regulatory dispute with the parties. The third branch of government you speak of is Congress, and maybe even John, you might weigh in this in terms of mens rea reform, which is currently before the Congress. They were talking about criminal law reform in terms of having statutes that are silent about what the mens rea standard should be, should have a default provision that includes a knowledge requirement. John, do you want to speak a little bit more about what's happening on the Hill on that?
Yeah, so mens rea, there's a whole bunch going on in the area of criminal justice reform, and mens rea reform is very much in the mix. So Orrin Hatch in the Senate has been a big proponent of mens rea reform. I've actually written and spoken quite a bit on the subject of mens rea reform, and Bob Goodlatte on the House has said that any criminal justice reform package that comes out of the House Judiciary Committee will have to include some mens rea reform. My colleague Paul Larkin has also written about another variation on mens rea reform called a mistake of law defense, so you can go to Heritage and look up Paul's thesis on that. And I would also note that a number of states, most recently Michigan, have passed what Paul just referred to as default mens rea standards that essentially says that if there is a criminal law that is passed that lacks a mens rea standard as to an essential element, unless the legislature makes clear in the law itself that it was intending to pass a strict liability statute, that a default standard should be inserted, whatever the default standard the state adopts. So mens rea reform is very much being discussed both at the federal level and the state level in various legislatures.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I don't see any questions pending. John, do you have anything else you'd like to cover?
No, I think we're okay.
Okay, would you all like to make some closing remarks?
Well, just briefly, I think this case really is symptomatic of what Justice Kagan said in the Yates fisherman case, that this is an over-criminalization a problem that's going on. And we think that this case is the ideal vehicle for the court to say, hey, look, if you're going to throw somebody in prison, we've got to make sure that they have this high level of mens rea, that they have knowledge, and that the lower standard of the deliberate indifference is something that Congress did not put in the statute. And again, this is a separation of powers problem, that if Congress wanted to have that in these all these criminal statutes, they could easily have put it in. So we're hoping that the court will grant cert. Just for your information, we calculate that the court will be reviewing this petition sometime in mid-April, where they'll have their conference. Is that about right, Jeff?
Yeah, it's either the April 13th or the April 20th conference.
Yeah, the April, so mid or late April, we will know whether the court will grant cert on this. And we have Justice Gorsuch coming to the bench, so we only need four votes to grant cert. And we've looked at some of his criminal jurisprudence, and we think he's pretty solid on the on the mens rea argument. So we hope we get the 4 votes, and I think we'll get the 5 for reversing.
It looks like we just got a few callers lined up with questions. Would you all like to answer the questions?
Sure, we've got some more time.
Great. Go ahead, caller.
I had a brief question. This is John Gadnarps, and hi, Jeff. There have been some references to an Eighth Circuit case. I've been having trouble tracking it. Did you say it's called Donovan? I've been trying to look it up.
It's U.S. X. Rel. Donegan. I can give you the site. It's 833 Fed 3rd, 874, Eighth Circuit 2016. It was last year. So read that case and also read the district court decision in that case, because that's where the district court slammed the Justice Department for saying, they should come to us if they're not sure about the regulation. And the judge said, nope, that's not the way it works. And if a company wants to take advantage of your sloppy regulations to make money, that's called the free enterprise system. Too bad. So that really is a good case in terms of trying to lay out this whole issue of at least of the false content. Okay?
I was spelunking through the Eighth Circuit to find this sort of stuff, so I'm kind of surprised and appreciate the lead. Thanks.
This is Jeff. There's another case, I don't remember whether it's the Eighth Circuit or Sixth, it's called Renal Care. Very similar concepts.
Great. Let's go to the next caller.
The microphone has been turned on. You have the floor.
Yes, hello. This is Bob Davis in Maine. I'm not an attorney, but I'm wondering if there's any expedited way you could get such cases that put people in jail for matters that they probably ought not to be in jail for, to get expedited machinery to get those cases before the president for pardon consideration.
Well, yeah, this is Paul. In terms of getting a pardon, the general procedure is that you have to have exhausted all your judicial appeals. So in this particular case, for example, if the court does not grant review at the end of April, then the Justice Department and the executive branch will entertain a petition for clemency, which can take one of two forms. It could be basically basically keep the sentence to what you've already served and you're out. A full pardon, however, doesn't usually come in until after 5 years of the conviction before you can get a full pardon. But I must say, under the Constitution, the president has exclusive and unfettered discretion to grant a pardon anytime under any circumstances. What I've just explained to you was the internal Department of Justice pardon attorney regulations for handling that. And I've used that a couple times, including the case I talked about earlier about the person who was convicted and sent to prison for 3 years of putting topsoil on his property. Unfortunately, we were not successful, but the president does have that authority to do that at any time.
So this is Jeff. The alternative is to try and prevent the injustice before it occurs, and that is if you are aware that your client is going to be or may be indicted, you try and run that up through the U.S. Attorney's Office to the First Assistant, to the U.S. Attorney, and if necessary, to Maine Justice, to try and convince them not to prosecute. Where you've got prosecutorial overreaching throughout, that doesn't always work. Sometimes people have very different views of the facts and the equities of the situation, but that is something that good lawyers and good white-collar criminal lawyers in particular use, is if they think they have a chance of escalating and convincing somebody not to indict, that's the way to go. And when you have an over-crim situation like this one, it is a good tactic.
Yeah, and to follow up on Jeff, then you can also remind the Justice Department on these regulatory offenses is, hey, look, if you have a civil or administrative remedy, we can do that in court. You don't have to use criminal proceedings on cases like this. Let's go before an administrative law judge, bring a civil lawsuit where you can have discovery, et cetera. But you have a lot of prosecutors that do abuse their authority. And I've seen cases, for example, going back to the wetland cases, where one prosecutor would take a regulatory nickel and dime wetland case where literally there were like 17 piles of sand on the person's property in Florida. They indicted the father and the son and got the criminal conviction and jail terms, whereas in another jurisdiction where it was a lot worse, the prosecutor said, look, this is a regulatory offense. I got drug cases to deal with. I got real crime to handle. EPA, you take care of it before your administrative law judge. So there's no rhyme or reason on this where you can have regulatory offenses where one's a minor offense and they get thrown in jail, and one's a major regulatory offense and it's just handled civilly.
And this is Jeff again. And don't underestimate the possibility of convincing somebody that they just shouldn't bring this criminally. There are upstanding government services throughout, both in, you know, their local U.S. attorney's offices in the hinterlands and at Maine Justice, and they generally want to do right, and the burden is to convince them that this is not the way to go.
Okay. Great. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.